Good afternoon, members and members of the audience. Transportation Policy and Finance Committee will come to order. And Representative Howe, have you had a chance to review the minutes of March 2nd?
Absolutely, and I've moved the minutes for to March.
Thank you. Representative Howe moves the minutes of March 2nd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Members, today we will have a presentation by the Department of Transportation, and we're looking forward to that presentation on how we go about our bid process and designing and planning, and we welcome them. So who would be up first from the department? Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the committee record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Gieske. I'm the director of the Office of Transportation System Management for MnDOT.
Thank you, Mr. Gieske. Please proceed with your presentation.
All right. Today I've been asked to come and talk a little bit about how MnDOT selects highway projects. We have a statewide transportation improvement program that contains about 2,000 projects in it in 4 years. So every year, MnDOT and its local agencies pick about 500 new projects to replace the old ones that get completed. So in this presentation, I'm going to focus on three topics that have to do with project selection. The first will be a description of Minnesota GO and the visioning process, which I understand is something you asked to hear about, which is a great place to start this conversation. Second, I'll talk about some examples of criteria that we use to pick projects. And then I will finish off with a third item that will review the process for how we go through the process of selecting projects. Project selection begins with planning, and planning always begins with a vision. Minnesota's vision for transportation future is captured in the Minnesota GO 50-year vision. The vision statement is this. It's quite simple, that Minnesota GO vision is Minnesota's multimodal transportation system maximizes the health of people, the environment, and our economy. So the process always begins with that, with the vision. The vision gives us the direction to know where we're going to go. The vision identifies some of the strategies or goals that we have for our program. It'll talk about things like ensuring accessibility, building to a maintainable scale, using partnerships, strategically fixing the system. These are all the kinds of statements that would come out of that Minnesota GO vision. Now, these words don't pick projects, so following the Minnesota GO vision, we'll have the statewide multimodal transportation plan. This is a little bit more detail. It talks a little bit more about specific strategies. It covers all the transportation modes, not just highways, but all the others that are in the family of plans at MnDOT. And then the third step in this process from plan to program is the State Highway Investment Plan. The State Highway Investment Plan we call MnSHIP. It's one of the family of plans. We have plans for aeronautics, for bikes, for other different modes of transportation. So this is just one of several, but this is one that I'm going to be talking about today as we talk about how we select projects. One point that I want to emphasize in the process of performing MnSHIP is how the public gets involved in that process. How do we set those investment priorities? Who makes the decisions on what those priorities will be? Really, the answer to that is that we all do. Deciding MnDOT's investment priorities is a process that we try to include everyone in. It includes all of you. It includes all the members of the legislature. The federal government has a role in what our priorities will be. MnDOT policy and technical analysis plays a role. We talk to stakeholders, our partners, to get their input. We also do public outreach to get input from the general public. We get feedback from the governor and direction from him. One thing about public opinion, which is maybe of interest, and in how we take that into account in our planning process, we use a really extensive effort to try to involve the public. And that, when we say that, we include also other government agencies and stakeholders, advocacy groups, and private citizens. We use several different ways to engage the public. We use meetings. We use workshops. We had an interactive website for the last MnSHIP cycle. We use webinars. We used even some social media. As a part of the MnDOT Stakeholder Highway Investment Plan, we engage the public and transportation stakeholders in this kind of innovative planning and scenario process, which you're seeing a picture of on the screen behind me. What we did was we presented to the public, to our stakeholders, three different scenarios. We had Approach A, which is the one that has most of the pie shaded green. This is a strategy where we try to keep our system in really top condition. We really focus on asset preservation, keeping everything in good condition. And then we showed them Approach C, where there's less green, only about half of it is green. In that scenario, we were saying we wanted to emphasize some other aspects of transportation system performance, like congestion, safety, perhaps economic development, and not maybe put quite so much into asset preservation. We presented those to the public as kind of two extremes of the spectrum on where we could invest, and showed them a middle option with Approach B, where there's kind of a blend. What we did with the public was, whether it was at the public meeting or on the website, was we asked them how they wanted to see their highway dollars invested. And it wasn't just asking them what they wanted to see more of, but we actually had them sit down physically in some cases with pieces of a pie and try to assemble that pie together into a round circle. So not only were they telling us what they wanted to see more of, but also where they were willing to take that money from in order to achieve those goals. So that's how the process works in the planning phase. And then when we get to the end, this is the end result. It's again, it is something in between. It was something relatively close to Approach B, which we presented. There is a focus on asset management as represented by the green slices of the pie. Each slice of that pie, although it's expressed in terms of dollars here on this screen, actually has an associated expected outcome. So if we were to read Minship, it would say $2.89 billion spent on pavement condition to achieve, and it would express that in terms of a condition of a percent poor and miles improved. And it would do that for each of those slices. So that's the outcome of the planning process.
Excuse me, Mr. Gieske, we have a question on this particular slide. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, as I look at this, I just don't understand. Could you help just define what project support is and where that $870 million gets spent?
Sure.
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to explain the slices of the pie a little bit, the green ones are all asset preservation slices, so pavement condition, bridge condition, roadside infrastructure, are you keeping things in a good state of repair. The yellowish shaded slice is traveler safety. Those are investments that specifically go for elements of the road that would promote traveler safety, like cable median barrier or some other types. The other slices, Twin Cities Mobility, is congestion investments in the metro area. The kind of pink one with the RC is the regional and community investment priorities. Project support then, which is about 11.5%. That's for things that we can't specifically assign to a project, but most projects have some of. That includes right-of-way purchasing. It includes consultants that are hired, external consultants that are hired to help deliver the program. It also includes supplemental agreements, and it's difficult to attach those specifically to a project in a 20-year plan, so it's expressed as a percentage of the total.
Mr. Gieske, would that include the requirements around complete streets? Are those all built into there, or is there somewhere where that would be, we could see that?
Complete streets elements could be in any of these. The bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure slices are things that are specifically for those types of things, but even a pavement preservation project could have striping or other elements that would be used to make a normal roadway into a complete street kind of roadway.
Do you have any calculation on what that does to overall projects as far as what percentage that might have increased the cost?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we have information recently. The information that's in Minship, which you see expressed on this pie chart, is based on what was spent in general historically in prior years. So we had been spending something around $100 million plus the bicycle infrastructure and the pedestrian infrastructure is eight. So about $220 million, it looked like, was per year. That was before Complete Streets was implemented. So it would be probably something more than that now, but we don't have recent figures for that.
Thank you. Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, my questions are related to pavement condition. And so many of our constituents and people around the state are very concerned about the deterioration of our pavements and things. My question is, I'm sure you rate them just like our cities do and everything else, but how often are you out there actually inspecting and rating and keeping that rating up to date? And then who is doing that?
Director Giesecke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the pavement rating is for trunk highways is done by our materials office. They have a van that is used to rate the pavements, the one that's in the picture here on the next slide. This is the vehicle they use. They drive over the pavements every year. They video them. They take measurements of the characteristics of the pavement, and then they update that annually.
Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up. So are you telling me like every mile of our trunk highway system is being inspected every year by these vans?
Mr. Chair, some elements are inspected on a continuous basis, like the ride, the smoothness. Others are sampled. So counting cracks, for example, they would do just the first tenth of a mile of every mile, so they don't physically count all the cracks on the entire system.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, well, since we've moved to the next slide, I'll move to the next topic. I wanted to give you a few examples of criteria that we use to select projects. So one example I'd like to use is pavement preservation projects, which is the largest slice of the pie. The most important criteria that we use to pick a pavement preservation project is the condition of the pavement. Pavement smoothness and the pavement structural quality. Those are pieces of information that we collect as technical data, as we mentioned, that this van will pick up for us and provide information on the status of the roads. Other factors that are used to select pavement projects include how well that particular project might help us to achieve our goals, both our MNCHIP outcomes and the required FHWA minimum targets that we would have. We also would look at project continuity, coordination with other state or local projects, trying to improve the most things that you can within one single project, which, of course, the pavement measure wouldn't necessarily tell you that, so they tried to bring in those other pieces of information. Different type of program category is Twin Cities Mobility. Metro congestion relief projects usually result from one or more studies that examine the performance of the trunk highway corridors in the Twin Cities area. The Metropolitan Council has a broader planning role, and MnDOT and the council work together to create a regional plan that includes transportation. Studies in the plan goals will then suggest that certain types of improvements would provide the most benefits, and some criteria that they use to select those are shown here. They include, does it create a predictable congestion-free travel option, such as perhaps a MnPass project might provide? Does it have a high return on investment? How much does it improve congestion with technology or operational changes, which are generally less expensive than infrastructure improvements? Does it address a congestion problem? Does it have a relatively higher traffic volume, and so on? And one last example.
I'll let you get through
this. Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll pass. It was from the previous slide, and it's not that important. I'll ask them offline.
Okay. Question. Thank you.
And one final example is the Regional and Community Investment Priority Project. This was one of the other slices of the pie. These are a little different than some of the others. They differ because on the other two examples, we were talking about projects that were identified by MnDOT performance measures. These tend to be projects that come about because they're a priority for the region, for the local government. They wish perhaps to create a stronger connection to another region of the state, maybe enhance the climate for economic development for whatever reasons they might have. This is a priority for them. And so we have some money that we set aside for that. So when we're picking these projects, we use different criteria than we might use for the others. Local government, of course, support for it is critical because that's the impetus for the program. How ready is it? Is the local agency ready? Is MnDOT ready? Do they have their funding in place? Does it have a good return on investment? What is the economic development potential? Again, these are some of the criteria that would be used with that kind of program. So really the point of all this is really just to show that when you have many different programs, different investment categories, that different criteria are used in different parts of the program. So with that, the planning is done. We have some criteria. Move into the process now for how we pick projects.
Okay. We do have a question. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could go back to the slide before that, please.
Sure.
Those criteria seem to be criteria that are very relevant to a highway in my district, numbered 14. And do you identify projects in the plan actually using these criteria? So are there in the plan that are you applying these criteria, and do we have projects set up in line to be built?
Dr. Giesecke.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if we jump back to this pie chart, which again, this is the outcome of the MnSHIP planning process, there is a slice of the pie which was $570 million that was identified for these types of projects. So, yes, most of the projects for that slice of the pie were identified in the plan. That included large projects like a Trunk Highway 14. It also included a lot of little projects that are simple intersection improvements that a city might want to do. So it doesn't identify them all, but large projects were identified.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, Mr. Giesecke, my obvious question is people where I live would just go, why isn't Highway 14 one of those selected projects when I look at those criteria?
Director Giesecke.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the MnSHIP process took all the input that it could gather from all those different sources, from the public, from all those different places, and put together this as the outcomes that the state of Minnesota wanted to achieve in their highway investments. And with all the other competing needs, they determined that $570 million was the right amount to spend, and that really, and I mean, it sounds like a lot of money, but over 20 years, that's not a lot of money. So it doesn't actually achieve a whole lot in terms of numbers of projects. So it's really just a matter of there's just not enough money in that category to reach down to all those projects that people would like to see.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Giesecke. I was looking at the Twin Cities Mobility Project slide, and I was just looking at the photo there, and it looked like there were like 19 or 20 lanes of traffic. I don't know how many. Is that one in the Twin Cities?
No.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, so, Mr. Giesecke, is that photo inferring to us that we've got a lot of room to grow our the size of our roads in the Twin Cities? Is that what we're seeing from that?
Director Giesecke.
Mr. Chair, I believe that was just an attempt to show the extreme of capacity projects. So, no, that's not a project in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, I told that's what Representative Hornstein was telling me. He said it's Twin Cities to Mazeppa. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that slide is really one I was inquiring about. I was struggling earlier trying to calculate everything, and according to that looks like about my calculations about just under $8 billion. How does that fit into the budget? Is that a particular biennial budget? Is it just an advance over a certain period of time? Exactly how is that calculated, and under what parameters are we looking at?
Director Giesecke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the first 10 years of MnSHIP. MnSHIP assumed no increase in revenue from new sources, only what current taxes would generate. And $18 billion was the amount it identified over 20 years, so this would be something a little less than half of 18. So your math is probably correct. But
okay.
St. Petersburg.
So if I understand, this is really the growth or the areas that we really wanted to propose for prioritizing above what our current funding sources are, or is it just our plans in general, and some of it's going to fit within our parameter of our budget?
Director Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure I understand the question. If you're asking how new priorities would fit in to this funding limitation, this is the constrained program. This is what we can do with the revenue that we have. If more revenue were available, it would probably alter people's desires and quite frankly, MnDOT's own recommendations for how we would spend it.
Then if I could clarify with that, so it sounds like this fits within the current budget of the funding constraints that we have today for the MnChip program over the next 10 years.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. This is his current spending.
Yep. All right, thank you.
Please continue.
Okay. Project selection is what MnDOT refers to as programming. So if I use the word programming, or if you ever hear MnDOT people use the word programming, that's what we're talking about. The MnChip plan is renewed every 4 years, but programming is done every year. Each year, MnDOT produces a 10-year work plan, which is a companion to the STIP, which is a very detailed document that covers years 1 through 4. The work plan is less detailed and covers all the years through year 10. MnDOT considers that the projects in the STIP are a commitment. The STIP is financially constrained, meaning that it is all within our expected revenues. Projects in the STIP have been scoped, which means that we have confidence that we know what each project will include, how much it will cost, and when it will be constructed. Years 5 through 10 are called the work plan years. Together with the STIP, these make up the 10-year work plan. We used to call that the Highway Investment Plan, or the HIP, if you've heard that term before. Projects in the work plan years, goes back to the question we were just discussing, are also financially constrained. So it's what we believe we can build with the budget we have. So they'll all fit within the revenues that we would get in the 10-year period. It does identify individual projects, at least major ones, for years 5 through 10. But some spending is only listed by category because it's sometimes difficult to predict where a safety project might need to happen 8 years from now. So there are some set-asides in it as well. Projects in years 5 through 10 are less developed. They may not be scoped, which means we haven't put some time investigating what the project might be. We may not be sure yet what that project will include or what it will cost. It's just a little bit less certain than the projects that are in the first 4 years. Ideally, a major project, if it went through just perfectly, would show up in year 10, and it would advance 1 year every year until it made it to year 1 and was eventually constructed.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, just a quick question. How does Corridors of Commerce fit in these plans like STIP and HIP? Where does that fit in?
Director Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Corridors of Commerce is another funding source, kind of like other state funds or federal funds. It comes for a certain purpose. So projects that are a part of Corridors of Commerce probably would have to be included in the STIP. If it's additional money that we didn't plan on, as sometimes happens, they have to be amended into the STIP or into the work plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So pretty much if a project is in Corridors of Commerce, it's also in the Surface Transportation Improvement Plan as a rule of thumb.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the STIP is a federal document, so we don't always put state-funded projects in the STIP, but in general, yes, I mean, it's in our plan.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Well, Mr. Chair, and MnDOT can perhaps clarify this. You know, one of the reasons that we started the Corridors of Commerce program is that there were a number of projects like Highway 14 and 94 and others that were, for whatever reason, not included in this process, or were far down in the process. Is that correct?
Director Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would characterize Corridors of Commerce as being kind of like another one of these programs. It's probably very similar to this one, the regional priority one. It has certain roads that are eligible. It has certain criteria that the projects have to meet.
Right.
So, yes, it does. It selects probably a different blend of projects than we would have selected without it.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you.
Director Gieske, I guess please clarify that again just for those two lines of questions. So Corridors of Commerce, the Highway 14, that would be in your STIP plan now?
Mr. Chair, the STIP would include projects that are programmed. So if Highway 14 is programmed now, it's in there. And that's true. I was reminded that projects that are not funded but want to be candidates for Corridors of Commerce can't be in the STIP. That's a provision of the law. So a potential project for Corridors of Commerce will not show up in the STIP. So I'm not sure if that was part of the question or not. But
well, it was because at first blush it was in the STIP, and now we're hearing that it's not. So thank you for clarification.
Okay. I'll have to check then and see which segment we might be referring to, because there were several segments of 14 that were in and out of the STIP. So
okay. Thank you.
I will check on that.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, for our discussion today, I broke down the programming process into seven steps that will help us kind of walk through who makes decisions and where those decisions are getting made, point out where the public has input into the process. Step one is the data collection process. We've talked about that a little bit already. MnDOT uses computer models called asset management systems. These systems recommend future improvements when they'll be needed. We have both a pavement and a bridge asset management system that provide us with data. These models optimize the resources and recommend where the improvements should be, with the goal of meeting a certain condition level, minimizing the life cycle costs. Other assets that are not pavement or bridge have a less robust kind of system, but we do have data on the other types of assets, culverts, signals, lighting, those kinds of things. We collect data about crashes, crash locations, other roadway characteristics that can improve safety. We collect information about traffic volumes. We receive information from our partners and the public about local priorities that come in all the time during the year, probably generally to the district office, but they could come in many places. This is all data that comes in that we collect throughout the year that we assemble as we begin the programming process. The second step begins with the district. The districts review all this data. They have a whole bunch of data that they have to look at. And that may look something like the picture of this map that is on the screen right now. A lot of different needs from different kinds of pieces of the system all over the place. Their job is to take a look at that and make some sense out of it, try to organize that into projects that might improve the most efficiencies, get the most return on investment. They use their expertise, their knowledge in the area, to change some of those segments to try and accomplish that. There's not a formal opportunity for public input at this stage of the process, but MnDOT, again, is continually receiving input from the public and partners over the course of the year, and they take that into account at this point. As potential project limits become identified, the district staff looks at all the other factors which might influence the choice. Some of those other things are listed here as well. How will it impact a community? Are there other conflicting projects going on at the same time? Is the detour route under construction? Is the money available at a certain time? They will consider all those kind of factors. And with the purpose then of coming up with some candidate projects, which then in step three they will take and try to narrow down and put it into a draft list of district projects. Typically the district staff will converse with their specialty office counterparts in the central office, the pavement engineers, the bridge engineers, to get their opinions on what timing might be best for different parts of the infrastructure. And when step three is done, the district engineer submits a draft program back to the central office to be combined with all the other districts in a state program. Step four.
Excuse me, Director. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And back on step three, when you've got a project that splits a district, which district, does each district engineer have to supply it, or does it get assigned to one district engineer? How does that process work when you have a project that spans over the district boundaries?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if a project extends over the district boundaries, generally the two district staffs will work together. They'll come to some common agreement on what's a good timing. They'll have to look at their own district budgets and see how to fit it together to pick a time when they can both work that out. But it's kind of a joint effort of negotiation between the two districts. Central office will help point out where those kind of projects are so that both districts are aware of the needs just on the other side of the line.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Step four is a review of the project list by the specialty offices in Central Office of MnDOT. They will take a look at what the districts have submitted. They'll run the pavement models and the bridge models again, make sure that the projects that they have suggested will achieve the outcomes that we're trying to achieve in MnSHIP. Again, going back to that pie chart with the outcomes, we want to make sure that the projects do meet those outcomes. If that doesn't happen, if it doesn't fit the budget, if it doesn't meet the outcomes, we'll send it back. We'll ask for some revisions to that. When it is finally finished and it's acceptable, we'll move on to step five. We'll do something that we call statewide balancing. Statewide balancing is we'll take a look at the program now as a whole, not just at a district level, but as a whole, and we'll ask ourselves, does this look reasonable? Are we making the right investments in the right areas? Is somebody getting more? Or somebody needing more, or somebody have a different problem that maybe we didn't review the first time around when we were looking at the technical act criteria. This assures that we've got equity, that we're achieving a similar condition all across the state. And that's the process that decides then what the draft state program will be. Step six, then, at this point, there is a formal public review. Each phase of planning, programming, project development all have their formal public review opportunities. When we did MnSHIP, there were public hearings. There was outreach that we talked about. When you're developing a project, there are smaller, localized public hearings about the project. Same thing is true in the programming phase. There's a notice published in the State Register. It's made available on the website, and people are invited to make their comments and send them back, generally to the district. The notice actually directs the comments to the district. Sends their comments in with questions or concerns or suggestions for additional projects, whatever their comments may be. After those comments are collected, the districts will make necessary adjustments to their program. They'll send it back in. There'll be one more final check. And in step seven, then, that final list goes to MnDOT senior leadership for their review and approval. We show them how we will be meeting the outcomes, how we'll be staying within budget. And then when that is all finally approved, the commissioner will give the final MnDOT approval. Just a couple words on program management, which is what happens in between times when we do this.
Excuse me, Director, before we move on there,
sure.
Please. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gieske, just wondering about local municipalities. Is there any special opportunity for them to be included and their opinions sought out at a different forum? I mean, it seems to me that they have, you know, direct and impact by any of these plans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that kind of involvement probably happens most at the district level. There are a few required formal events for public hearings, like the ones I just mentioned, where it's just kind of broadcast at the State Register. But those kind of conversations that you're talking about are really part of that relationship that a district has with each of its cities and counties, and they have planners and programmers who will carry on that kind of conversation, sometimes through the ATP, sometimes directly, but that's generally where those conversations are being had.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to that, I've been hearing from some local communities that when a state project goes through their communities, sometimes there's some cost sharing that goes on with that that is borne by the local communities, and sometimes at least some of them feel that they're uninformed about that. So do you know, is there great pains taken so that these municipalities and others know what their cost share is ahead of the letting of the project?
Director Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, those kind of things happen at the district level, which is not really my area of expertise, but I am sure that they do make attempts to communicate those things as early as they possibly can, because the ability of the local agency to pay their share is very important to the completion of the project, and if they don't have their share, then the project will suffer. So I know that they do try to make those contacts early and try to make it very clear. Yeah.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, to the point, having just been a mayor, and Representative Uglum can also speak to this, we, as municipal leaders, you are very much in tune with the district representative, and you are kept aware of what's going on and what that local share is. So it is handled at the district level, and it is very well spelled out.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. The last slide, but to talk a little bit about program management. In between programming cycles, of course, things happen, and we have to manage the program and the projects as they come in. As I mentioned before, ideally, a project would come in year 10. It would travel all the way through 1 year at a time and be built when it hit year one. That would be wonderful if all the projects did that, but they don't. Sometimes the reality is not quite that ideal. For various reasons, projects move in or out. Forward or backward, issues arise that may change the cost. We might get comments to change the scope. The funding may not arrive exactly as we predicted when we laid it out for 10 years in advance. Projects in STIP years 1 through 4 have the most certainty. Ones in the later years, especially 8 through 10, have the least amount of certainty. And so we do have to make changes during the year to make sure that happens. A little bit of note about Next 10 that's mentioned on here. Next 10 was our effort to describe what we would do with about $6 billion over the next 10 years if we had it. It was done in a very similar manner to the way we would do our normal programming process. It was based upon the values and the objectives of MNCHIP. Of course, with a different level of money, though, things change, so it's not exactly the same distribution of resources that was in MNCHIP, but it did go through the same kind of process. The projects that are in Next 10 were projects that were unplanned, so there's not necessarily a lot of information available on them yet because they were unplanned. So for that reason, there's more uncertainty than there would be in your normal plan to project. They were selected in a very similar kind of way.
So, Director Gieske, in that regard, then you were suggesting that the HIP plan, for example, would take these projects, a project that has been designated as going ahead, and it would start at that 10-year mark and filter down kind of through the process. So is it suggested that all those 600 not hand-picked projects would do the same thing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, that obviously we'd have to change that and introduce them earlier in the process, put them in earlier years, so they wouldn't have that benefit of going through all 10 years.
So we would change our whole process for all those 600 projects.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, getting another $6 billion over 10 years would be a drastic change to the assumptions we made in MNCHIP and would warrant us really doing MNCHIP over with a whole new set of funding information and presenting that to the people and asking them what they would like to do with that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gieske, along that line, so I know the governor came out with his proposal with this long list of projects. How did we get to that list of projects if it didn't go through here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it did go through the process to the best that it could. Remembering that these are projects that we weren't planning to do before, and now we were thinking, well, what would you have money to do then? What would we do? We do have data on all the roads. We know what their condition is. We can make projections about when they might fail, when they might need work. And so we have some data to work with. We don't necessarily have all the other information gathered, but we do know a few things about it. So we can make some assumptions. And again, when you're making predictions about things that are 5 or 10 years out, it's you don't know for sure, especially when you haven't done that background scoping kind of work. Even talking with the local agencies about a project that previously hadn't been planned and now might be, you're going to want to talk to them. So all those kind of things need to be done. That's why those projects had such a wide range of costs in many instances, because there's still a lot that's not known, but we do know some things about them. So I would say we are probably at least like in step 3 or 4 somewhere with that right now. It hasn't gone through the bigger public process, but that's kind of where it's at right now, I guess, with its debate here in the legislature too. So
I'm just cussing.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Gieske, so it sounds like there were varying levels of involvement in the process among many of those large list of projects that we had or that the governor brought forward. So we just abbreviated the process and just kind of threw the list together. How did we get, obviously we didn't have community input meetings for probably most of those, and there's probably other parts of these this process that, like you said, weren't done. So it was really a fundamental deviation from the process. Is that what we're saying?
Director Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Minship process had extensive public involvement. We asked the people, how would you want your resources invested? Where would you want them to go? What kind of things do you value? That was the underlying information for all of Minship. Next 10 is an extension of that kind of public involvement. There hasn't been detailed project-level involvement with locals on some of those projects because they were unplanned. So they haven't been through that kind of detail. But the public in general has told us how they want things to be done and how they would like their money invested and what goals they want to achieve through the vision, through the multimodal plan, and through Minship. And so it's very consistent with what the public has told us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Gieske, it kind of sounds like a dodge of the question. I mean, the question is, did we make a fundamental deviation from the normal process to come up with this list that the governor brought forward?
Director Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it followed the process to the extent that it could in the time that it had. It's not completely through the process, but it's been following the process. It's been based on data. It's based on our Minship investment goals. It's based on what the public has told us they want. It follows the criteria that we've used to select projects. So in every way that it's been developed consistently with the way we develop other projects.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gieske.
And Director, we'll move on. Just a question. If a project goes through the Minship criteria, how long does that take?
Mr. Chair, the 10-year work plan it covers projects for 10 years. The programming process is annual. So new projects might emerge on an annual cycle. So if the question is, how long does it take a project to get into that process? Mm-hmm. It can show up within the following year.
Okay. And how long did it take for the 600 project list to be put together?
Mr. Chair, we've been looking at that for several months to determine what we might do. It was part of the Minship process on what we would do with more money. The Transportation Finance Advisory Committee asked similar kinds of questions about what would your needs be if there were more money. So those kind of concepts have been worked on for quite a while.
Okay, we'll move on. Thank you.
And that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Director Gieske. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Good afternoon.
Director Roy.
Thank you, Chairman, as well as the committee for this time. My name is Christopher Roy. I'm the state design engineer, but I'm also the director of the Office of Project Management and Tech Support. And in that office, we have our alternate procurement methods, which are design, build, and CMGC, as well as our design, bid, build letting processes. So today we're going to talk a little bit about design build and kind of just step you through the design build program, how those projects are selected for design build, and just touch on some of the other items that would pertain to design build. So a little bit of background about design build. MnDOT started the design build first projects back in the late 90s, but those were pretty rudimentary sort of projects. It was in the early 2000s when we really took a hard look at what was the best way of doing design build, and we did it in a systematic way where we developed these four books, and only one of the books actually changes on every contract and contains project-specific information. So contractors are much more familiarized with the rules of the game because the other three books more or less remain unchanged. And over time, we have changed those books a little bit, just evolutionary sort of things. But since 2002, that idea of those books has been around, and contractors know how to play by our rules associated with those books. Since that time, we've delivered 29 projects. 19 of them have been best value. A best value contract is where we take a look at a technical score. A contracting team puts together a technical proposal, and then we evaluate that technical proposal, score it, and then and only then do we open up the prices. So it's a combination of that technical score and the price is best value. We've done 10 projects that are low bid. So essentially they put a technical proposal together that is scored, but it's scored on a pass-fail basis. As long as they pass, we open up those bids, and the contractor with the lowest bid receives the contract. In total, those projects in design build, we've done $1.6 billion worth of work in that 20-year period or so. On any given year, probably in between maybe 20% and 30% by dollars of our projects go into design build, but that varies from year to year. And by number, it's a very small number. It's only a couple of percent of projects that are going design build each and every year. We deliver in between 225 and 250 projects on an annual basis. We do probably about 3 to 5 projects design build.
Representative Petersburg. Excuse me, Director Roy.
Yes. Thank you. If we could just go back to the best value, to me that kind of leads into the question of subjective, objective as to how the scoring actually occurs in best value. Do we have any parameters given in which best value has some, is taken out of personal preference versus actual reality of whether or not it's the best value?
Director Roy.
Chairman and members of the committee, I've got a couple of slides coming up, so
okay.
I'll work through those, but if you still have the question at that time, just let me know and I'll certainly clarify.
All right, thank you so much.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this particular slide, you say that some of the design build projects or whatever are limited to 10% by statute. How does that work, and does that tie your hands? Because it seems that design-build nowadays can offer some real values. I wasn't aware of this 10% statutory requirement. Could you expand on that?
Director Roy.
Chairman and members of the committee, the 10% is by number. Since we deliver in between 225 and 250 projects annually, we could do 10% of them using design-build. So we could be in the 20 to 25 projects on an annual basis design build. Currently we're only doing about 3 to 5 projects that way, and that's because design build is not necessarily the best method for every project. So we go through an evaluation process that I'll touch a little bit on trying to determine what is the best procurement method for the particular project at hand. So does it really tie our hands having this 10% limit? I would say at this time it does not. Maybe a little bit more into the future, as that mix of projects kind of change a little bit and how we do some of our delivery methods, it might need to be revisited, but at this time, 10% is a fine number and we can live within that.
Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would certainly hope you'll be back to us so we can lift that limit if the market conditions make it necessary. Thank you.
Representative Whelan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was actually my question.
Okay. Thank you. Director Roy, please proceed.
So talking a little bit about design build, some of its strengths, some of its weaknesses, touched a little bit on that, but not every project is well suited to being a design build project. The benefits of design build are really listed here. Accelerated delivery. It's a wonderful means in order to get a project developed very quickly, but also constructed very quickly. If you think back after the 35W bridge collapse, the new bridge was constructed using design build. That bridge collapsed on August 1st, and about 13 to 14 months later, we were able to drive on the new bridge, largely because of design build. The way that design build accelerates projects is that the designer is designing it in a very fast-paced environment right there with the contractor. So they're determining the best means and methods in order to design that project that suits the contractor's needs, and they're able to actually design parts of a project, have the contractor start constructing that while the rest of the design is still ongoing. So it's a very fast way of designing as well as building a project. Risk transfer is another benefit to a design build, and what that means is that when we develop a project, every project has some risks, and we're able to address those risks through our design, but sometimes we don't guess risks in the same way that a contractor would. And a contractor can do different mediation or mitigation to those risks in a way that suits that contractor better, resulting in either a faster construction or possibly a lower bid as well. So we talk a great deal when we're thinking about which projects to go design build. How much risk do we want to transfer to the contracting team? Is it reasonable to transfer that amount of risk? Do we want to keep it? And that's kind of the bullet of risk transfer. Competing in innovative designs. Because of design build and there's multiple teams going after it, each designer has a little different take on how they're going to do it with their contractor team member. And so you end up with many different ways of designing that project, and some of them have some strengths and others will have some not quite as strong of strengths over there. So that's how we start to do some of that evaluation between these in that technical phase. And I'll get a little bit more to that scoring so that it isn't, it is a very objective way of scoring. ATCs is alternate technical concepts. Through design build, we're allowed, we've got a certain set of rules that a contractor has to try to design and build within, but through an alternate technical concept, he can propose a slight variation to those rules. We evaluate that variation and we determine, is it a better than or equal to our original proposal. And if it is, we'll allow that, and the contractor can put that in. And so we actually increase the quality of the product. Maybe it's the speed in which they can build it. There's lots of different things that can happen through those ATCs, and they've been proven to be a very worthy concept that was able to speed up construction and also reduce the overall cost. And lastly, one of the benefits is flexibility. Through design build, you can come up with many different ways of building a project. You can look at using maybe different markets or different market trends out there. Some of our larger bridges, maybe the Hastings Bridge, for example, there were different concepts that could be done. Some were using steel, some were using concrete. So you can cater and have flexible designs that would cater to the contractor in order to try and give us the best value, the best, the lowest price as well. Design build isn't for every project, and that's why you see that only a handful of projects each and every year. There are some drawbacks to design build. So projects that are smaller or not near as complicated, those projects generally don't make very good design build projects because of the effort that goes into procuring a project through design build, and then also the efficiencies of design bid build is very much more elaborate in design bid build. Being able to deliver those non-complicated sorts of projects. Design build, we have a little less, MnDOT, the owner, has a little less control over the design because once we hire that contractor and we agree upon a certain set of rules, they go in and they do that design. We verify that it meets our standards, but we have a little less control over exactly how it's designed. There's some third-party agreements or permitting things that also come up where we would transfer some of that those permits or some of those agreements over to the design build team, And we have to consider that if we're going to be using design build. Does that project have some of those, and what would the consequences of that be?
Director DeRoy, we have a few more questions. Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the typical design build situation, why was that limited to 10% by statute? For any particular reason, or they were being cautious? Or are you actually suggesting, with all the good things you say, that there are too many problems with going whole hog on it? What's the reason?
Director Roy.
Chairman and members of committee, I believe the 10% was probably selected so that we would not go to tip the scale too heavily in design build. When we first started, I believe that was part of the legislation back in the early 2000s when that was passed, and it was probably a compromise that was stricken between MnDOT and the AGC so that we didn't have every project going design build. Now that we know more about design build is an appropriate use and procurement method for many of our projects, but not necessarily all of our projects. So that 10% is about right right now. A couple of years from now, maybe when things change, maybe it would need to be revisited and go up a little higher.
Mr. Chairman, you did the double again after telling us
all right.
how good it is. Then you said, well, it isn't quite suitable yet. You're satisfied, Mr. Chairman, with the way it is right now, apparently?
We are.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Director. Chair Earhart, follow-up, or are you...
No, that's it. Thank you.
I think, isn't there also kind of a scale of value to some projects that are very small and simple really aren't necessary to go through design build as well? So there is some just size scope that makes a difference as well, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, thank you. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, you talk about some of the drawbacks to design build and everything else, and design oversight resources. I'm assuming that because of the design build process and the intense activity and building as you're designing and everything else, that you have all kinds of inspectors out in the field during the process, but yet you have gone through the contract and the specifications and things. Could you expand on this resources and your costs involved with that?
Director Roy.
Chairman and representative, design oversight resources, really what that is a couple of fold. You're absolutely right about the construction inspection. However, on a design bid build job, we would also have construction inspectors out on the job. Design bid build projects tend to be a little bit, let me rephrase. Design-build projects tend to be a lot more faster-paced, so the intensity of that inspection tends to be higher. So it calls for a higher level of resources for a relatively shorter period of time, whereas design-bid-build tends to be a little bit longer duration on our projects. The overall inspection for construction reasons is roughly the same between the two. The other element, though, is in design. As the contractor and their consultant partner is designing it, there is MnDOT people there doing oversight, or we would consult out to a consulting firm to do that oversight for us. So there definitely is some of that resource drain as they're doing that design. The amount of cost associated with doing that is similar to design bid build, but the duration and the timing of it is very different. In design bid build, we would start a process and we would either design it internally or do it with a consultant, and we do it in a more just a normal process. It's normal speed. We deliver it in a very traditional way. Where design build, time is money to the contractor, and they try to do everything as fast as they possibly can, and so the resource drain is much higher. But it is over a shorter period of time, so there is some costs that are offset there.
Representative Uglum.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Director, well, yeah, but isn't, I mean, you're building the same project and things. Aren't the overall costs for these oversight resources the same in design bid build as well as design build? I'm looking at that and I'm going, why is it a drawback? I mean, the price and costs and things are going to be the same. It's going to be a faster pace. But why would that be a drawback?
Yeah. Director Roy.
Chairman and representative, the drawback is that it's that fast burn that we would need to do, and the cost of that oversight for design build might be slightly higher than if it were a design bid build, but there is some offsetting. It's close.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Roy. So, does MnDOT keep have you done kind of a summary of past design build projects and compared them against projectedly what they would have cost under a bid build scenario and looked at and analyzed accumulative savings from those projects? Could you characterize those if you have?
Director Roy.
Chairman and Representative. Yep. Have it right here. Under cost efficiencies. So the middle part of the page there, we talked about some of the cost efficiencies associated with design build. The one that probably comes out the most often when we talk about cost efficiencies are those ATCs, that alternate technical concepts. That saved us on average about 3%. Now, the other thing that ATCs can do, they can actually cost us a little bit more, but there is a savings to the public associated with it. It can be either through the means of less impacts to the traffic, maybe an interchange is closed for a shorter duration, but it may cost us a little bit more. But the ATCs overall, we do that evaluation in order to try and make sure that we're coming up with the best value sort of arrangement as we put together our construction documents. So the ATCs have saved us roughly 3%, and that is through looking at all of our design-build projects and looking at ATCs in particular. That 3% is actually a little tough to get an exact number on, because we ask contractors to submit the ballpark at which they believe it's either going to cost or save the contract, but we have no way of actually verifying that that's the exact dollar amount that would be saved or increased with their ATC. We go back and we verify it and make sure that it's in the right ballpark, but it may not be specific. It gives you a rough idea. Another area where cost efficiencies are in there are change orders. Our design bid build process, as the project proceeds, there's change orders in every contract, and those run roughly 6% in design bid build, whereas they're only about 2% in design build, so there's a reduction in the savings there. And in the value engineering area, there can be some tremendous cost savings. On the segment of 610 that was built in about 2008-2009, one of the contractors and designers were able to figure out a way of changing the profile of Highway 610, which probably lowered their cost by maybe $10 million or so, and that was seen as a direct savings because that was a bid, and that was the amount that was bid, and that profile change of that highway just changed how they were able to move less dirt, utilize some of the sand that was in place. Those were all things that they were able to do through their value engineering, things that we hadn't yet got to that as we were doing our design. So it was seen as a savings.
So, Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Roy. So it might be rhetorical, but does that 3% reduction include the opportunity cost of money or not? Or is it just looking at cost and cost?
Chair and Representative, right now it is more based on cost. It is not necessarily opportunity of cost associated with that savings or additional cost. So it would be just a pure dollar savings. If the opportunity costs were in there, it'd probably be a higher number than that.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was actually going to ask you about the I-35W bridge, because I thought until I turned the page and you have that on there. But it seems to me that there are some problems with cracking of some sort. Now, I don't know if that's been rectified, but I did read in the paper that there were some cracks that appeared, and I'm wondering if that be the case, is that anything to do with the rush to get that done in 1 year instead of 2.5 years with the design build thing.
Sure.
Director Roy.
Chairman and representative, I'm not familiar with the with any cracks on 35W Bridge, so I'm not able to comment on that. I think that'd be a topic if you're interested in. We can certainly get back to you and check into that.
Well, I drive over it, Mr. Chairman, and I want to check.
All right. Certainly somebody from our staff will contact the bridge office, and we'll be able to get back to you on that.
Good.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you ever determined that the project is right to design build, and then you're into the project and something so dramatic changes or happens that you think this was a mistake, this is, we've got to change our direction?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Chair and Representative. As far as getting into a project and really getting into the meat of developing the contract and the RFP and changing your mind at that point, I'm not aware of any situation like that. There was one instance where we went all the way through that procurement process. So we had an RFP. We had teams propose back on it. And when we opened up the bids, the bids came in differently than we were expecting, much higher than we were expecting. So that did cause us to kind of retool and look at why was it as high as it was? What could we have done differently? And how do we still build the project, but we do it at a lower cost? And that was an instance where we, after that retooling and thinking about it a little bit more, where we ended up going design bid build on that particular project. So that might have been one that maybe it wasn't quite right. But that's the only one that comes to mind where it's even familiar or vaguely similar to that.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Roy, is there any advantage of design build to large or small contractors?
Director Roy.
Chairman and Representative. If you going back to that first slide, you can see that we have had some contracts, $1 million, $2 million in nature, and contracts at that dollar amount are not going to attract very large companies. There are more medium-sized companies that are interested after that, or possibly a couple of smaller companies. Even on our largest projects, while we might have a large company as a prime, they will have plenty of subs on their team as well, and those subs tend to be made up of relatively small contractors compared to that prime. So does it necessarily favor one or the other? Design build probably does not favor one or the other. But it's a little bit more project specific. If it's a larger project, you're going to see a larger contractor be the prime.
Thank you. Please proceed, Director Ryan.
Okay. Looks like I've got 8 minutes before something happens here, yeah. So I'll try to go fast.
That's perfect because we've got about 12 minutes left.
All right. So one of the things that we do here is as we get into a project comes to us and we need to decide what is the best delivery method for that project. So when we talk about a selection process, we talk about these factors: cost, schedule, project complexity, innovation that might be involved in a project, current status of design, how far is it designed right now, the available workforce, and then that risk allocation that I talked a little bit about. Those are the considerations, the factors that we look at and we weigh our projects against when we're talking about a procurement method and what is the right one to take. In this area, when we do this, one of the things that we'll typically do when a project comes to us is we'll actually have a workshop where we talk about these in a little bit more detail, and we make sure that the right selection or the right procurement process is actually selected, whether it's design build, design bid build, CMGC. We go through that based on these factors here and make sure that we're making a good selection. That process has actually been used here, but it's also came from Colorado DOT, where they've used it quite a bit, and then we made modifications to it for Minnesota. So scoring. There was a question earlier about scoring, so there's two types of design build that we do. It's a low bid and best value. The low bid, like I mentioned before, is more of a pass-fail on technical proposal, and then it's based on the value of the bid, and the whoever has the lowest passing bid is deemed the contractor that we work with. Best value is where we take into the technical proposal, and we score that, and then when we finally score that, we open up our bids, and then we do a computation to figure out what is the best value contractor. Best value is best for major bridge projects, complicated projects, projects in urban areas, whereas low bid is for more of the less complicated projects. There's minimal risk transfer, and it tends to be where our lower dollar value projects are as well.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I've got a couple questions about best value.
Okay.
And I think we all understand low bid.
Yep.
That's pretty simple, and we get the most bang for the buck with your specifications that are written. Best value is pretty subjective sometimes. And my question is, I have a couple of them, but one of them is, like, when you talk about best value and the way that you score things, and maybe some contractor can leave an intersection open for a period of time and the other one maybe doesn't think about it or whatever, but is still the low bid, but you turn around and give it under a technical scoring best value deal to the guy that decides he's going to leave the intersection open, and then maybe it doesn't get left open. I mean, how do you really balance this subjectivity that happens in this bidding process?
Dr. Roy.
Chairman and Representative, it's a pretty thoughtful process that we go through. First, we take a look at the goals of the project, and based on those goals of the project, we actually create our scoring criteria around those. So if one of the goals of the project is to maintain traffic through the project, that would probably be one of the scoring criteria that we have. We make available all of those project goals to our contracting team. It's available to anyone, but the contractors are nowhere to find that. We also go through and we create our scoring criteria. Contractors are aware of where our scoring criteria is, and we go into as much detail as we possibly can about where those scores are going to be and how many points are going to be on this category versus one of the other categories. All that information is made available to the contractors prior to their proposals coming in. During that proposal writing period, we have a series of one-on-one meetings. So it'd be MnDOT with one contractor. And in that conversation, the contractor is able to ask us questions about, you know, if we were thinking of this, what would MnDOT think of this? And typically we look at it from only a technical standpoint. You know, is that a proposal that we could entertain a little bit further? And if so, then we would, the contractor may decide to put it in as an ATC, which actually has a formal vetting process. And if approved, the contractor has a choice of either submitting it with their bid, and if they do that, it becomes a part of the contract. It's contractual. So they have to do that particular element. The rest of the proposal is actually contractual. So if they make commitments inside of that proposal that they will close this intersection or not have it closed for more than 4 days, 5 days, whatever their commitment is, that's a part of the contract. If they do not follow through on that, there are penalties, or penalties could be associated with that lack of follow-through based on that contract. The subjectivity part, we really try to take it out by giving very specific directions to all of our scorers of our technical proposal. They have very, very tight scoring sheets, and on those scoring sheets it will say there's 2 points for this area and 0 points. They kind of give them some benchmarks as to how they should be scored. Each one of the review committee reads the proposal and does that scoring themselves. When they've scored it themselves, they come back together as a committee and they have that discussion and conversation around it. We call in technical experts where needed. So we really do try to take out as much subjectivity as we possibly can. In the end, all of our scoring criteria, as well as our score sheets themselves, are posted on our website, so any contractor can see it once the contract has been awarded. They can look at their own, they can look at the winning bid, they can do the comparison. So you're right, there is some subjectivity still there, but we have done steps to make it as objective as we possibly can. Talking to the Federal Highway Administration, they tend to view that Minnesota is one of the best states as far as removing that subjectivity compared to many of the other states that are still doing a design build.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, maybe that's true. Sometimes I think it's like a diving meet where everybody holds up fives and tens or whatever, or gymnastics or something. But you know, I'm particularly concerned about sometimes the scoring and things. Well, you have more beautiful lighting on a bridge or other things like that because we like your architectural design. But yet, you're certainly not the low bid, and in these days of very scarce resources and more bang for the buck, how can you tell me that this is really best value?
Chairman and Representative.
Director Roy, before you answer, I think we want to do something with your software there so that we don't have to restart everything. Okay. You might want to either... There's no pressure. There's only 17 seconds.
I do not know what to do.
He needs someone who's 21.
It's gonna blow.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, if it's all right with you, I do have my PowerPoint up here, and we'll work off that. You have copies as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I apologize for that. I'm not a computer guy, as you noticed.
Well, as you can tell, none of us jumped up to help you, so you can continue with Representative Uglum's.
Yep. If you wouldn't mind paraphrasing the question again.
Representative Uglum.
Well, I mean, how can we be assured this era of, you know, we really have scarce resources and we want to get the best possible amount of money out there and get these the best possible bids. And yet we're saying this is a best value bid type deal, and we're scoring this on a subjective basis. It's really the chicken before the egg type thing. I mean, when we have a low bid process, we got a low bid. And here we frequently don't. I'm very concerned about that. What can you tell me about that?
Chair and Representative, in many instances, the best value contracting team is also the one with the low bid. That is not always the case, but that is most commonly the case. And why that is because the team that has the best technical score usually goes in and figures out how to do things differently than every other team. And that differently usually is a result in either faster or less expensively. Faster is also time to the contractor, which is relates and translates into money. So that's usually what happens. Does not always happen. There's a couple of notable examples, 35W and MinPass. And in those instances, the contracting team was able to do something different. It wasn't necessarily, you know, how pretty a bridge looked or anything like that. It was based on that scoring criteria that we gave them. The case of the how they lit a bridge or how they provided lighting on a project, that would only be scored and be a difference if that was a part of the scoring criteria, the aesthetics of the particular project. I don't believe that we've had aesthetics on any of our scoring criteria, certainly in the recent past, and maybe never. MinPass was an example where a contractor was able to come in there and do it with less user impact. And that user impact, we did a quick calculation to see what that user cost would be associated with MinPass. And it was greater than two times the cost of the what ultimately ended up being the price difference between the company that received the bid versus the lowest bid on the job. So they were able to come in and impact the public in a way that was very different than the lowest bid proposal. And in that particular case, I think Best Value was appropriate because we are giving something very different to the public than what we would have done had we selected only the low bid contractor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so what type of redress does a contractual firm have if they feel that the subjective best value bid, that they were wronged, and that they feel that they want a rescore or whatever? What type of redress do we have there for that?
Director Roy.
Chairman and representative. A couple of things happen. First of all, the scoring criteria is given to all contractors prior to proposals, so they can ask questions, they can ask clarifications, they can debate whether or not that is the right scoring criteria for the project. The clarifying questions, they can try to figure out exactly what is in each one of these categories. So going into it, they have opportunity to make sure they understand or have the same understanding as what we're looking for as they want to be able to provide. After the proposals are scored, there is some availability for contractors to take some actions. Most notably would be the protest period. We do have the ability for any firm to put in a protest. The protest is a written protest that is submitted to Department of Admin. And an admin official reviews not only the case made by the contractor that submitted the protest, but MnDOT also supplies a brief on what we believe has happened. And then that protest official makes a recommendation and a ruling on what they believe is the right course of action. So far, I do not think we've had any situations where it's been overturned, but some of the protest areas have given us some thoughts on what we need to do differently on future projects. So you know, it isn't that we've done anything wrong, but there's maybe a better way of doing something. So we've changed that, made that modification for that next contract.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like that response. That's good. Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Early on, before I actually got on the City Council, I was observing how that there were several projects that the city had done, and they had, very shortly after they were completed, there were problems. And it was always the same contractor. So I asked one of our council members, why is that? And it was because they were always going with the low bid. So I think I'm very, very cautious on the low bidder.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Roy, this best value, is that where we get the pretty bridge versus the strong bridge? You know, we I've seen in parts in southeast Minnesota and north central Minnesota, the Twin Cities, you'll see all these neat decorations along the walls, and you'll see these big pillars that come up that hold enough concrete to probably put a half mile of road in. How does pretty get injected into these road and bridge construction projects when I think Minnesotans want safe instead of pretty with their limited road dollars? How does that happen in this process?
Director Roy.
Chairman and Representative, on design build, we do not score aesthetics, or at least that's normally not a scoring criteria. So on every project, design, bid, build, design, build, of a bridge or of a corridor running through a city, we put together an aesthetic design guide. And that aesthetic design guide, it gives us what the look of that highway should be. The retaining walls, the abutments on the bridge, the piers themselves, maybe the bridge railing. It gives us some idea as to how that all ought to look. A lot of the concrete that's there, whether it's the retaining wall or the abutments or the bridge rail, that's all form liners. So it's a relatively inexpensive way of actually getting the retaining wall or the bridge abutment to look like stone or brick or whatever they choose. So generally, it's not adding very much cost to a project. There are exceptions to that where we have gone over and above that, but then the aesthetic elements of the project are actually subject to our cost participation policy. So the local government, city or county, would say that we want something over and above what we're providing. So the city then cost participates in that additional design. An example of that is the Edgerton Bridge over 694. The rail that's up on that particular bridge, that was more expensive rail than standard, so we did the cost participation with the city in that case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed, Director.
Okay, so I'm on the slide design build scoring with the two pictures there. We talked about that technical review committee, that there are at least five members. One of them, I should point out, is an AGC member. General contracting is appointed by the AGC is what it is. And that helps a little bit with the subjectivity as well, in that he's coming at it from a general contractor sort of point of view and adding value that way. At the end, after each individual scores that technical proposal, we put them together and we do the average, and that becomes the technical score that we use on the next slide. If you could drop down to the design build scoring here, to get that adjusted score, we take the proposal price, or the price of the proposal, and we divide that by the technical score that is the average of that technical reference committee. And then we get our adjusted score, and that is the best value contractor, and that is the one that we would start negotiating with in order to proceed. And what's coming up, but that is the last slide. So I know that it got a little out of order, but I'll stand for any questions that there might be at this point.
Questions from members. Representative Uglum.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
questions.
What if we, the way that we're doing design build and design bid build and everything else, how are we compared to other states? What are other states doing to squeeze scarce dollars? Are they doing anything different than we are at this point in time?
Director Roy.
Chairman and Representative. As far as design build goes, we're in a very elite group of states. There's very few states that have a better design build program than what we do. That's by the FHWA, and even our contractors will tell us that they enjoy working on design build projects here much better than many other states. Although I guess I'm also the state agency, so I don't know what else they might say. Nonetheless, the FHWA backs it up as well. So other areas that we could that we were investigating is something called CMGC. Recently, we received authority through the legislature to do 10 pilot projects of CMGC. And CMGC is a little different style of procurement, where we hire our contractor as we're designing the project. And it's kind of a cross between design build and design bid build, because we're designing with the contractor's input, but we hold the design. We're the ones either designing it, or we hired the consulting firm to actually do the design. And with that input, then we start negotiating prices with that contractor. A few other things that I haven't talked about that we are starting to do as well is something called IDIQ, and that's a indefinite quantity. And what that is we enter into a contract where we say that we would like a contractor to do chip sealing on one of our highways. Minimum value is this, maximum value of the contract is this. They put a bid together, and then we go out and we create work orders, and we tell them to go do it on this highway, do it on this highway, and as available funds are made or come available, then we can add additional projects onto that. And that's a great way of our end-of-the-year spending. If there's a couple of projects that came in under, we're able to get that dollar, make use of that dollar by doing that. Some of our design bid build projects have some very clever incentives built into it. We've done A plus B bidding, which is a way of getting the contractors to competitively bid on how long it's going to take to do a particular project. We've done locked incentive date sort of clauses in incentives, which would mean that if they get something done by this date, we will give them an incentive, but by taking that incentive, they waive their right to any claims. So it's a mutually beneficial sort of incentive. Let's see. We've done a lane rental as well. Lane rental is where contractors might take a lane for a period of time, but we charge them more if they're taking it during peak periods versus maybe weekends or nights or some such thing. So really what we do is between the FHWA and just meeting with our counterparts, where something has worked very well in a particular state, it takes very little time for that word to spread to everyone else, and then we try to incorporate it. Most often what we do is we do it in steps. We do kind of a pilot project first, we learn a little bit about it, and then we introduce it as a broader program. We're very interested in continuing to make sure that our dollars go as far as possible and that we're using the taxpayer dollars as efficiently as possible. And I think some of these procurement methods are very good ways of doing that, but they're not necessarily right for every project. So that's why we go through the selection process to make sure we're picking and doing the right process for the right project.
All right. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, just kind of curious, what happens when you go over budget on your aesthetics and landscaping, for instance, if the project plans maybe double? Director, where does where does the money come from, and how do you deal with that?
Chair and Representative, through the design process, we're continually estimating the amount of aesthetics, the cost of the aesthetics that would go into the project. There are some guidelines as to this type of project. It might be 3% aesthetics, it might be 1%, could be 7%, but there's guidelines as to what that percent is. And we continue to do those estimates. And right before the project is let, we do one more estimate, and we do a verification that we are in the right ballpark as to the cost of those aesthetics. If something is out of kilter at any point up until letting, we go back, we retool the aesthetics so that it comes back down to within those guidelines. There are times where we actually under-design in aesthetics because we've kind of done all the aesthetics that the city or the community would like to have, and we still haven't hit that cap, but that's a cap. It isn't a mandatory that we have to spend that amount on aesthetics. Once the project is bid, it becomes a little harder to manage that cost. Because some of those aesthetics are actually built into the cost to build an abutment, for example. So it's hard to really figure out how much is that aesthetic treatment on that bridge or that abutment for the bridge might actually be. But there are elements of aesthetics that can be bid by themselves. Maybe landscaping on a job. And if that seems to be very high, we can either go to our supplemental agreement pot of money, which Mr. Giesecke spoke of earlier, or we can go through a process in working with the contractor to maybe eliminate some of the component that's causing the price to be higher. We do that also in conjunction with the city because the city was expecting a certain level of aesthetics, and we want to make sure that any change we make is that the city is aware of it as well. So it's kind of depends on where the project is and how much we can break it out, but we do try to hit those targets. It's certainly not exceed them, and if by chance a project would happen to exceed it, there is always a course of action that we can take to try and get it back closer to where we had expected it.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, do you have any additional comments that you care to make regarding Highway 62 and I-35W monuments? Was in the paper, looks like December of 14.
Director Roy.
So, Chairman and Representative, I'm not terribly familiar with the monuments that you speak of. It must be on the Crosstown project?
That's correct.
Unfortunately.
And that's fine if you're not prepared. That's okay.
Representative Bernardi, one final question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, we don't have much time left, so maybe I'll ask you as a chair if this is something that we can talk about later on. I think it's an important discussion. It's an important discussion, and Mr. Roy brought it up, and it was about cost participation. And as I'm listening, I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if people really realize that cost participation isn't always things that are just aesthetic. And to know a little bit more about what is in cost participation, and as I'm thinking about this, cost participation often falls on business owners in projects like this for pedestrian lighting or something like this on a trunk highway project that goes through a main street or through an urban area and stuff. And I know cost participation has been brought up as something that's going to been proposed to being changed within MnDOT if, and I think that's what I've heard, if more funding becomes available through a big transportation package. Could you just give us a brief comment on that, and then, Chair, if this is something you feel would be of interest for the committee to gain more knowledge about?
Director Roy?
Chair and Representative, our cost participation is determined by policy, and that policy is available online. Most cities, most counties actually probably know the policy better than we do. They know it so well because they want to be able to say that, no, your policy says that we should be paying for this. We go back, we verify, and they're exactly right. All of those elements inside of that are made available to anyone so that they know what they're getting into before we start a project. Some elements are just a part of the project, storm sewer, for example. If there's a certain amount of water that comes in off of our property, say from the city, the city then has a cost. We have a cost participation policy that would say the city is responsible for a portion of the cost of this, the storm sewer, because a portion of the water is actually theirs. As far as the cost associated that go back to businesses, it's certainly not directly that it goes back to businesses. Our cost participation policies, as well as our cooperative construction agreements, which is the agreement that we have with the municipality or the county in getting the transfer of funds back and forth appropriately, that always goes to the public agency, the city or the county. Now, the city may choose to assess the businesses that are going to benefit by the sidewalk or the lighting there, but it isn't necessarily MnDOT that's per se taxing the business. It would be the city that makes that decision. As far as a reevaluation, we did go through a cost participation policy, a revisit of it, and that occurred, probably took us about a year, and probably came out about a year ago, that revised policy. And it's a policy that's been a long-standing one, and what we did this last time when we revisited it, we just made sure that it was still appropriate and that it addressed some of the newer things that we were starting to construct, roundabouts or some of the innovative designs that are occurring at interchanges. So that's more or less what we touched on. When we did that, we had some level of involvement from our cities and counties, but since it was just a kind of adding a couple of things and making sure we were covering some of the newer roundabouts, for example, some of the newer things, we didn't have broad context as far as a lot of public involvement, but we did have some. When we wrote it the first time, we had extensive public involvement from cities and counties, and they were very key in helping us write that policy. Most cities and counties also have a cost participation policy of their own that they apply on their projects. Counties would have it so that in sharing costs back down to the cities. And cities may have it and how they assess different parts of the project. So our policy is not unique, and it's one that's been recently revisited, but it hasn't been totally rewritten for probably about 12 or 14 years.
Thank you. Well, thank you, members. Thank you, Director Roy, for being here. Director Gieske, we appreciate your time with the committee. We will be putting off our discussion on the public partner private partnerships till next Thursday, where we have added a committee meeting. After session, it'll be approximately 4:30 or call of the chair. Our next meeting is Monday. We do have MnDOT back with our multimodal discussion, and then we also have a bill to hear. So that is our plan for the upcoming week. And thank you for all your questions and your attention. No. This meeting is adjourned.